And that flute music can only mean one thing. It means we've reached that hour or that moment in the hour when we talk to the fabulous Flora Lichtman about the video pick of the week. Flora, what's up?
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Flora.
Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be here, and thank you so much for having me. Okay.
Okay, down to business.
Down to business.
This week, we have a story about scientists who have basically made a stun gun for worms.
A stun gun for worms.
Very important research.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of worm, you know, worm attacks are being rampant all over the place. No, it's more important than that.
All right, so here's the story. Neil Branda, who's a chemist at Simon Fraser University in Canada, and his colleagues took a nematode worm, also known as C. elegans, this experimental model organism. They fed it a light-sensitive chemical. So that's a chemical that changes when you expose it to different types of light.
Mm-hmm.
And then they shined the worm with UV light.
Ultraviolet light, okay.
Ultraviolet light. And something kind of remarkable happened. First, the worm turned blue, which is kind of a side point, and then it became paralyzed.
Paralyzed.
So here's where the stun comes in.
You don't think it's just resting?
Apparently enough worms started resting after
okay.
the UV
so
light.
So they decided it was paralyzed. Okay.
And then the next part, and here's where it's new. When they shined the worms back with visible light, they started moving again.
So this was a reversible stun
mechanism
that's switched on and off by light.
Right.
And
you can see it on our website at sciencefriday.com.
I knew that was coming. No, I have to confess, I took a peek at it. It's pretty remarkable. You should go have a look. Flora, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's it for today's hour. Flora Lichtman is the digital media producer for Science Friday, and that was her you were just hearing. This program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is the producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher is our science arts producer, and Shelley Dubois is the Spanish language producer. Neil Rausch is our technical director, and he's here. I can see him at the controls in New York City. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write to us, you can send us a letter by U.S. mail, Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can use that new thing we call email. That address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today, there was good and surprising news on the employment front. According to the government, the economy shed just 11,000 jobs in November, far fewer than expected, and the unemployment rate edged down from 10.2% to exactly 10%. But analysts say the nation's job troubles are not over. NPR's Frank Langfitt explains.
When the Bureau of Labor Statistics released its jobs numbers this morning, economists were delighted.
I was surprised, and I've gradually sort of relaxed into happiness about it.
The panic is over in terms of the job market.
This was a much stronger employment report than we were expecting.
That was Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute, John Sylvia with Wells Fargo, and David Weiss of Standard & Poor's. In the previous 3 months, job losses had averaged over 130,000. So even President Obama was surprised the November figure was so low. Christina Romer, the White House's chief economist, described their exchange.
When I told the president, he said, "You mean 111,000 job loss?" I said, "No, it's 11."
Beyond the headline figure, the report contained other encouraging data. Heidi Shierholz noted that businesses gave workers more hours.
That is a really crucial signal, because what we know is that employers will restore the hours of the workforce they have before they hire new workers.
Temporary employment, another leading indicator of job growth, rose by more than 50,000. David Weiss says one reason job losses are ebbing is because consumers are a bit more optimistic.
some of this is psychological, that people panic in the beginning of a downturn. We certainly saw that 6 months ago. Everybody was convinced the world was coming to an end. And when they realized that it wasn't, they're out there a little more confident in spending again. But there's also a natural cycle here. You can only run inventories down so far before you got to start producing again. It's the old analogy that, you know, eventually you got to replace the light bulb, and that requires going to the store and buying something.
The employment numbers are a shot in the arm to the White House. Republicans have criticized President Obama over the dreadful jobs picture. And just yesterday, the White House held a summit to address the unemployment problem. At a town hall meeting in Allentown, Pennsylvania today, the president touted the November numbers.
So overall, this is the best jobs report that we've seen since 2007.
Then he tempered it with realism.
But I do want to keep this in perspective. We've still got a long way to go. I consider one job lost, one job too many.
The job market has a very long way to go. Since the recession began 2 years ago, more than 7 million jobs have disappeared. Sectors such as manufacturing and construction continue to shrink, and it's taking longer and longer for unemployed people to find new work. Even when jobs begin to grow again, economists expect the unemployment rate will increase. Heidi Shearholt says that's because, at first, monthly job gains just won't be enough to absorb new workers.
The population is growing all the time. New babies are being born. There's new graduates being minted. So unless we're adding roughly 127,000 jobs, the unemployment rate will rise.
Shearholt says she doesn't expect the job market to really start growing until spring or summer of next year. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
Tis the season for the various renderings of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. This year there is the animated version, which you can enjoy in 3D. Or if you're more inclined toward the traditional, there are assorted audio readings, such as this one by the late British actor Paul Scofield.
Once upon a time of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house.
Dickens himself used to perform A Christmas Carol, but as NPR's Margot Adler reports, he didn't perform it as he had written it.
If you walk into the New York Public Library during this holiday season, you can look into a small glass case on the third floor in the reading room. Isaac Gewurz, the curator of the Berg Collection of English and American Literature, explains.
The most prominent item in the case is the prompt book of Charles Dickens for A Christmas Carol.
And what's a prompt book?
A prompt book is a book that prompts the reader on giving a performed reading of a text. In Dickens' day, public readings of fiction or of poetry was not done. It was considered a desecration of one's art and a lowering of one's dignity.
But forget about dignity. Charles Dickens, according to Gewurz, gave perhaps 150 public readings of A Christmas Carol over his lifetime. The first one went as long as 3 hours. Later versions took about an hour and 25 minutes. And when you look at the prompt book, he cut out a lot. Complex sentences were replaced with simple ones.
What's interesting, though, is to see how much of the atmospherics have been deleted. Scenes that set the mood in the streets of London, for instance.
And often anything to do with the state of mind of a character that could be conveyed by tone of voice.
You will notice that in the right-hand margin to this page there, it says tone to pathos. So you have many of these kinds of cues to himself, how to modulate his voice, what kind of emotion to convey at the time.
So those classic renditions of Dickens, like the one by Paul Scofield here?
Come then, returned the nephew gaily. What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose? You're rich enough. Scrooge, having no better answer ready on the spur of the moment, said, bah, again, and followed it up with humbug.
Be advised, they may not be as traditional as you think. Dickens himself changed Dickens. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
And you can see the edits in A Christmas Carol in Dickens' own handwriting at npr.org.
Thank you.
Well, now we are going to talk about Tiger Woods. Like it or not, the Tiger Woods news has led to a lot of jokes. Did you hear the one about how Tiger has a lot of expensive cars, but now he has a hole in one? Or how Tiger changed his name to Cheetah? As NPR's Mike Pesca reports, in this age of Twitter and timestamps, you can trace jokes that have spread far and wide back to their humble origins.
Humor can be dissected as a frog can, E.B. White once wrote, but the thing dies in the process and the innards are discouraging to any but the pure scientific mind. Notice the animal he mentioned was a frog.
One of the women who claims she slept with Tiger Woods says that they never talked about golf during sex. Yeah. Yeah. However, contractually, Tiger was obligated to talk about Nike, Gatorade, and American Express.
Conan O'Brien has had a laugh a night since news of Tiger's SUV accident broke. For Jay Leno, about 10 jokes a night is par for the course.
Well, apparently she took 8 swings but only wrote down 5. See, there's a million. You can do these all day long.
Yes, you can. Already a photoshopped image, artist unknown, of a beaten-up Tiger posing next to his golf club-wielding wife, Elin, has pinged around the internet. Most shared jokes are also of unknown origin, like the one about Tiger hitting a fire hydrant and a tree because he couldn't decide between an iron or a wood. But these early public domain jokes tend to have something in common.
There's all these puns.
Bill Sheft has written for David Letterman since 1991. He notes that in the early stages of a public scandal, the jokes tend to be accessible because they need not only amuse the audience, but be fun to tell.
If you're an amateur joke writer, this is a dream for you because everybody knows the basic things about golf. I mean, you know, thank God he, you know, this isn't like a guy that was a professional curler.
Sheft isn't putting down amateurism. He's just delineating the difference between a public domain joke and a proper monologue joke, which ideally imparts some information. Conan's "A woman who slept with Tiger Woods said he didn't talk golf in bed," that's a monologue construction. Public domain jokes sound more like this one.
What does Tiger Woods do better on a golf course than he does with a Cadillac Escalade?
Bob Lurie heard this one at his investment banking firm. It was essentially the same joke Kevin Quinn tried to tell.
What's the difference between an Escalade and a golf ball?
Let me step in here and punch this thing up a little bit. What's the difference between a golf ball and a Cadillac SUV? Tiger Woods can drive a golf ball 400 yards.
That's a beauty.
Bill Sheff says that is a pristine public domain joke.
I don't have any of my archaeological equipment, but I'm going to bet that that joke was written about 5 minutes after the accident.
No carbon dating needed. We can search Twitter and find out that on the morning of November 27th, just as the news had broken, Nick Alpin of Orlando, Florida, went on his computer and typed, "Tiger Woods can drive a golf ball and not a car." Alpin explains his creative process.
I figured he either is not a very good driver. And then when that came into my mind, then driver, you know, the connection, the obvious connection and everything.
Drive a car, drive a golf ball, and there you have it. Now, Nick has 68 followers, so it's not like the world ripped him off. But the drive and drive concept was so appealing that the line was repeated, reposted, and refined. Within a day, Twitter shows it had taken riddle form. Another reason why this might be the most retold Tiger joke is that it doesn't deal with any sexual issues, and it doesn't require the audience to follow breaking news. For that, Letterman returns next week. In the meantime, there's Jay, Conan, Kimmel, Fallon, Wanda, George Lopez, Saturday Night Live, and the collective consciousness of the web, allowing a million amateurs to make like Elin Woods and just tee off on Tiger. Allegedly. Mike Pesca, NPR News.
And that flute music can only mean one thing. It means we've reached that hour or that moment in the hour when we talk to the fabulous Flora Lichtman about the video pick of the week. Flora, what's up?
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Flora.
Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be here, and thank you so much for having me. Okay.
Okay. Down to business.
Down to business.
This week, we have a story about scientists who have basically made a stun gun for worms.
A stun gun for worms.
Very important research.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of worm, you know, worm attacks are being rampant all over the place. No, right. It's more important than that.
All right, so here's the story. Neil Branda, who's a chemist at Simon Fraser University in Canada, and his colleagues took a nematode worm, also known as C. elegans, this experimental model organism. They fed it a light-sensitive chemical. So that's a chemical that changes when you expose it to different types of light.
Mm-hmm.
And then they shined the worm with UV light.
Ultraviolet light,
okay. Ultraviolet light. And something kind of remarkable happened. First, the worm turned blue,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a side point, and then it became paralyzed.
Paralyzed?
So here's where the stun comes in.
You don't think it's just resting?
Apparently enough worms started resting
right,
after
okay,
the UV
so
light.
So they decided it was paralyzed. Okay.
And then the next part, and here's where it's new. When they shined the worms back with visible light, mm-hmm. they started moving again.
So this was a reversible. Stun
mechanism
that's switched on and off by light.
Right.
And
you can see it on our website at sciencefriday.com.
I knew that was coming. No, I have to confess, I took a peek at it. It's pretty remarkable. You should go have a look. Flora, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's it for today's hour. Flora Lichtman is the digital media producer for Science Friday, and that was her you were just hearing. This program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is the producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher is our science arts producer, and Shelley Dubois is the Spanish language producer. Neil Rausch is our technical director, and he's here. I can see him at the controls in New York City. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write to us, you can send us a letter by U.S. mail, Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can use that new thing we call email. That address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. On Capitol Hill, senators are continuing their health care debate, but we thought we'd provide a little explanation in plain spoken English of what they're actually talking about and what it might mean for you. Earlier this week, we asked you to submit your questions about the bill. Now we're going to get some answers with the help of NPR health policy correspondent Julie Robner. Julie's here in the studio. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
We had several questions from people who are self-employed and have to buy their own coverage. This one comes from James Stouffer of Delafield, Wisconsin. He says, there's a lot of talk in the current proposals about eliminating denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions. Does this mean that self-employed people will no longer have to disclose their health history or go through underwriting to buy coverage? If this is not the case, what's to stop insurers from simply rating up applicants with health issues in lieu of denying coverage? Doubling or tripling the premium is the same as denial of coverage, isn't it?
Well, to answer the second question first, yes, hiking the premium to make it unaffordable is often tantamount to denying coverage. And no, insurers won't be able to do it anymore under the bill. And once the bill fully takes effect, which isn't until 2014, by the way, self-employed people won't have to disclose their health history or go through underwriting to buy coverage. Insurers, in fact, will only be able to vary what they charge in premiums to people in the new marketplace called exchanges for a couple of variables: how many people are in your family, whether you smoke, your age, where in the country you live, and whether you participate in a wellness program.
All right, Julie, here's a math question. It comes from Richard Zimmer of Charlotte, North Carolina. Let's listen.
I'd like to be able to understand contradictions from three financial claims about the Senate health bill. First, that it will save $130 billion over 10 years. Second, that it will cost $800 billion to $1 trillion over 10 years. And third, that it will not add one dime to the federal deficit.
All three of those statements are true at the same time, believe it or not. The Congressional Budget Office says the bill will cost $848 billion over 10 years. Over that same period, the bill also raises $978 billion in new taxes and fees and reduced spending for Medicare for a net reduction in the deficit of $130 billion. So at least in that first decade, it adds not one dime to the federal deficit. In fact, takes a whole lot of dimes away.
Okay. Now, here's a question on Medicare from Evelyn Kirsten of Boca Raton, Florida. She wants to know, what adverse changes can seniors anticipate if health care legislation is passed, particularly with the addition of millions of baby boomers to Medicare?
Well, the idea, of course, is to prevent adverse changes for seniors in the program. The Medicare parts of the bill are actually aimed at giving doctors and hospitals and other health care providers incentives to provide better care rather than just more care, which is the way the system's set up now. The hope is to at least slow how fast spending is growing, not really cut the program in actual terms, so Medicare can be sustained for those baby boomers. Now, one controversial thing that is in the bill would undo something Republicans did in 2003, which was to give big raises to the private plans called Medicare Advantage. Today, those plans get about 14% more than it costs to care for each of those Medicare patients. And some of those payments do go towards giving patients benefits Medicare wouldn't otherwise cover, like eye care and foot care. The patients will still have all the benefits guaranteed by regular Medicare, but those people could lose some of the extra benefits that the plans have been providing with those overpayments.
Now, here's another question about insurance companies. This comes from Heidi Wehner of Moab, Utah. She says she has health insurance.
But over the past 5 years, I've found that my insurance company regularly denies all claims over about $100, even ones that they've pre-approved. It takes hours on the phone demanding to speak to supervisors for the insurance company to eventually pay. And to me, this seems like a breach of contract done in the hopes that people will not fight the fight and just pay. Will either of the current bills in Congress do anything to stop this despicable practice?
Julie, I think we heard frustration in her voice. What's the answer to her question?
Yes, of course, it's already illegal for insurance companies to deny coverage of things they are contractually obligated to pay for, but this is a pretty common complaint. So the bills don't have to make it illegal again, but I think the idea is that the competition created by these new insurance exchanges will make the companies better about customer service, that knowing people can switch plans every year might curb these kinds of abuses.
Thank you, Julie.
You're welcome, Michelle.
That's NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner, and thanks also to our listeners for sending in their questions.